Good afternoon. I'm Chris Spangle. I'm the publisher of We Are Libertarians. I'm the guy who edits all the podcasts. So luckily, I had not yet finished editing this episode of We Are Libertarians. And the president just gave an address this afternoon, Saturday. We recorded this episode on Friday night at 8:30 on the August 30th. And the president gave a speech from the Rose Garden regarding Syria. And I'd like to play you a little bit of that just so we keep this episode as up-to-date as possible. The information and the wargaming and the strategizing within the episode is all still relevant. And we'll give you more context into what is about to take place. But I'm going to play for you now the relevant parts of the president's speech, and then I'm going to give a little bit of analysis afterwards. So, and then we'll begin the episode. So now is the president of the United States this afternoon.
It endangers our friends and our partners along Syria's borders, including Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and Iraq. It could lead to escalating use of chemical weapons or their proliferation to terrorist groups who would do our people harm. In a world with many dangers, this menace must be confronted. After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. This would not be an open-ended intervention. We would not put boots on the ground. Instead, our action would be designed to be limited in duration and scope. But I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out. Our military has positioned assets in the region. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has informed me that we are prepared to strike whenever we choose. Moreover, the chairman has indicated to me that our capacity to execute this mission is not time sensitive. It will be effective tomorrow, or next week, or 1 month from now. And I'm prepared to give that order. But having made my decision as commander-in-chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress. Over the last several days, we've heard from members of Congress who want their voices to be heard. I absolutely agree. So this morning, I spoke with all four congressional leaders, and they've agreed to schedule a debate and then a vote as soon as Congress come back into session.
That is President Obama announcing that he will follow the Constitution as written on this particular issue, that when Congress gets back in session here within the next week, members will start filing back over the next week, and then they return, I believe, on September 9th is the date. And, you know, that session has 40 days, and it was going to be full of Syrian talk. But it was presumed, especially as we talked last night, that he would move unilaterally of Congress, of NATO, of the UN, of Great Britain, and our only ally really in the Western world would essentially be the French. And anytime you've got the French on your side in a war, you know you're doing well. So Turkey, also a part of NATO, also calling for more than just surgical strikes. They essentially want an occupation of Syria by the U.S. troops. Turkey, yeah, we heard your suggestion. Thanks a lot. So what does this mean? Essentially, this is, in my view, a very smart move by the president. As we discussed last night, none of us really felt like the president thought that this was something that he'd like to do. But he felt like he needed to keep his word after the red line comment. And this is a fairly smart strategy because you know you're probably going to lose this vote in Congress and in the House. And then you are able, as president, to blame non-action in Syria on the Congress, on the members of Congress, and specifically the Republicans, which is pretty typical of Barack Obama's MO. Now, the other part of it is that, yes, if it goes down, it will be seen as an embarrassment for the president, as it is seen by most members of the media in the UK, for David Cameron, who made the case and lost in the British Parliament. But the president's going to lose no matter what. He's going to lose face here, because 70% of Americans do not want us to be involved in Syria in any way. And that is after seeing the horrific pictures that came out of that Syrian bombing. I mean, people don't want us to go over there. And 80% said that they didn't want us to get involved without congressional approval. So, you know, which is the worst embarrassment for Obama? If you're his advisors and you're sitting there calculating it, do you want to go against a war-weary nation by starting another war and really ratcheting up the calls for your impeachment? Which, as we discussed, it's pretty much, you know, Old Faithful. You hit the second year, your second term, the other party starts calling for your impeachment. But this would be a pretty serious violation of the Constitution had he moved unilaterally. One thing that I think that this does, I mean, he's going to be embarrassed if he loses, and probably when he loses this vote, but it's going to be less embarrassing than starting a war and that being the legacy of your presidency, especially when you were a candidate who had so much invested in being an anti-war candidate, in speaking out against Iraq and speaking out against our foreign interventions all the way back to 2002 up until he became president. And then he had a complete turnaround. So he railed against Bush for not seeking the approval of Congress, not getting a declaration of war, moving without the UN. And it was really puzzling that he would, as president, do the exact opposite of what he said in previous, you know, in New York Times op-eds, in speeches, calling Iraq a dumb war, being opposed to the dumb war. That is one of the most, that is one of the quotes that is thrown back in his face. So this makes sense if you're Barack Obama, if you're one of his advisors. Put it on Congress. If it fails, yeah, you have some egg on your face, but it's not the kind of egg that is, oh, I don't know, bombing another country without congressional approval. The other aspect of this is Assad. So what does this now mean for Assad? It gives him a few options as well. This is a chance for him to just lay low and essentially end the civil war. Now, is that what's going to happen? I highly doubt that. I would say that what he will probably do is double down. He will start a war of words with the United States, try and engage on the world stage, and try and make Obama and the United States look like tyrants. And very similar to what Benghazi Bob did in the lead up to the Iraqi war. I find it hard to believe that at this time they would release more chemical weapons. There was certainly a door open that the president left in his comments about Assad, that he could take action and would take action, and they are ready and breathing down his neck. So I highly doubt that Assad will do anything that will just punch it up. Although there was the alternative that he could double down and just really go off the deep end. But what I think is most likely is that he will now lay low and try and fight this on the world stage through the UN and through the press. So it will essentially remain business as usual. This is, for the Republicans, and Rand Paul especially, this is a great thing. This is going to put Rand Paul especially in the limelight. He has the opportunity for the next 2 to 3 weeks to... He won't be focusing on defunding Obamacare. This kind of lets Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, who pushed the Obamacare defunding, and they don't have the votes, and that was going to be potentially embarrassing, that will kind of get forgotten in all of this when they come back, and they can unfortunately drop it. I think probably 99.9% of this audience would like to see Obamacare defunded. including myself, but the votes are not there. And it was going to be something that the media was going to take the quote-unquote libertarian Republican wing of the Republican Party to task on. And this can kind of help them hide that a little bit. And Rand Paul will lead the pack in the Senate and Justin Amash in the House. If they're smart, they will, and they are, they're media, very media savvy. I think you will see Justin Amash and you'll see Rand Paul a lot, because they're the Republicans that are non-interventionist, or as close to non-interventionist as we might have in the Congress. So I know many of us in the libertarian movement would like to see, you know, far more action from our libertarian Republican congressmen, but you do what you can in governance. So we will see. I think this is a great moment for both of those two particular, because this gives them another voice similar to what Rand Paul had with the filibuster. Gives him a lot of face time to lay out a foreign policy that looks different from the president and appeals to liberals and appeals to conservatives. This vote is not going to be right and left. It's not going to be like budget issues. This is going to be all over the place. You're going to see Democrats revolt from the president. You're going to see Republicans side with the president, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham. It's going to be very interesting. Really adds a layer of complexity to this upcoming session that is going to be interesting to watch, because the debt ceiling, if you haven't noticed, the debt ceiling on the debt clock has not moved in 30 days, I think it is, because the Jack Lew's just basically lying and saying that we aren't spending money, and we all know we are, and they're going to hit the default and stop paying certain bills in mid-October, and they've got to have that debt ceiling raised, and you know what it's been like the last couple of times. You know it's going to be like that. And then on top of that, you add congressional approval of Syria. So buckle up. It's going to be a very, very interesting view and fun to watch. And please, 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 please share this with people who want to know what's going on in Syria. Even if you think they can handle it, this one might be a little scary for people. But, you know, educate yourself about Syria. Educate yourself about the debt ceiling. Educate yourself about the immigration policies, these big issues that are going to be discussed in the media. And like I said at the end of this episode, 70% of people were paying attention to everything that was happening with Edward Snowden. That was a poll that came out this past week. And you are providing information on Facebook and Twitter and to your family that can help sway public opinion. And I don't think there's any doubt that if there hadn't been the amount of outcry the last few days over intervention, I think Barack Obama would have already been launching missiles. He leaves for Russia here in the next 48 hours, I think, 50 hours, and would have launched it. And now we're going to go to Congress, where it's probably going to get turned down. And that kind of pressure you can apply by just making your friends and family aware, so and giving them information. So that being said, we now head right into this episode of We Are Libertarians. Thanks for listening. We greatly appreciate it. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle. To my right is another host, Greg Lenz.
Hello, everybody.
And online is Creighton Harrington. And you are sporting quite the lovely beard, sir.
This is America, and I am a male, and
yes,
we are
having Gina might stop by. She might or might not have forgotten about the podcast, which that's always great. So she'll be here in just a few moments, but for now, it's an all-male cast to wash the taste out of our mouths of that feminism show, Greg.
Disgusting.
I'm just sorry that the weight of manhood's too much for you guys, and you can't, you know, grow a beard.
It's not fair. I can't grow a beard at all, and it's not fair of you to rub that in.
Even Joe Dirt tried, all right?
That's why I hang out with Rupert, is my inadequacy as a man to grow a beard, so that way people won't notice. Because he has, it's like when you hang out with a fatter person than you, so you look skinny.
Exactly.
Right, so
you're framing yourself.
Right. Creighton, how is life at YAL? You are now living in D.C., and you're out there full-time. No, you're in Alexandria. That's D.C. It's more D.C. than
it's,
Greenwood.
It's not. They gave it back in, like, the late 1800s.
So how is life at Y'all?
It's not bad. Not bad. Getting work done. Getting, you know, promoting liberty amongst college students, as always, but...
Meeting chicks?
You know, I mean, yeah, maybe.
All right, well, that's excellent. Always good.
Showing off my gymnastic talents.
Well, I wasn't going to out you if you weren't going to out yourself, so.
What? I'm okay. I can do a backflip. What?
No, not what that. Else? Your giddy schoolgirl proclamations of true love on Facebook.
I can
that
do
that. Is not even close to what it was.
Uh-huh.
I was just amazed that it happened to me.
Uh-huh.
I can do backflips. It just takes several men to help me do them, so. All right, let's jump right into it this week. Enough chitter chatter. It's time to get serious. We are on the brink of war. I don't know if we're even going to be able to cover other topics because there's so many layers to this. And, you know, there's very...
Plus we haven't prepared any other topics.
Well, now listen, we're trying to sound professional. Stop. You know what? There's a... I wish I had one of these when he's live. Mute. So, all right, so... We sit on the brink of war. John Kerry came out today and made a passion speech. And so here are the details of what's going on. Greg, jump in and give details as you see I'm missing them. Let's start from the beginning. Over the past few months, there have been unreported reports, according to the New York Times at War blog, roughly 35 chemical strikes by the Syrian government against their own people, but they were against troops. And they were not very big, and we could not really prove that those were necessarily chemical strikes. And then on August 21st, it became very evident that there was a large chemical weapon strike. And the administration today for the first time said that they unequivocally believe that that chemical strike was carried out by Assad.
Highly probable.
Highly probable.
A little CYA there.
Right. That it was... but. There's leaks out of the intelligence committees that the information is not a slam dunk, which is ironic, that phrasing, because the phrasing that the CIA chief used when they were talking about WDs in Iraq, when he was outlining his intelligence to Bush, he said, "Sir, this is a slam dunk."
Yeah.
So at least they're saying this is not a slam dunk, but that's not going to stop them from taking us to war. So on August 21st, a large chemical attack took place in Syria. And a little over 1,400 people were killed in the attack, and two-thirds of them were women and children. And almost a year to the day before that, President Obama had given a speech where he had drawn a red line, and he said that a chemical attack or the moving of chemical weapons, because they were watching the stores, and there was a report out today that the American government actually... picked up chatter and saw the chemical weapons being moved before the attack, and had they acted, they probably could have stopped the attack, but they did not. So it was carried out, and he drew this red line, and he said that we have to take some sort of action. Now, he didn't say military action, so somehow we have ended up here a few days later. This is the 30th, so we're now 8 days after the attack. And we're on the brink of war. We didn't jump into diplomacy. We didn't jump into anything. We just immediately said, "Well, we got to fire some missiles at them." So the British, yesterday, as we record this on Friday, and by the time you listen to it, all this information may be totally moot because we're supposedly launching the attack here in the next 72 hours. Obama actually leaves for the G8 summit with the Russians
in St. Petersburg.
In St. Petersburg in Russia. Hope your channels of information are secure, because I just have a sneaking suspicion they're going to be spying on you now.
Yeah.
And so before he leaves for Moscow, it is anticipated that he will attack, and they are roughly 12 hours ahead of us. We're in Eastern time. We're here in Indianapolis. And... so this information, we're sorry if it's outdated, but this is kind of where we're at the moment. And John Kerry came out today and gave an impassioned speech and framed it as an issue of national security. So ironically, it's been John Kerry who has led the way. Chuck Hagel gave one fumfering press conference this afternoon overseas. He's a dove. I mean, he was against. Yeah. He's most likely against what's taking place. So John Kerry really has led the onslaught here, and the.
There's no one below cabinet level that wants to pursue this.
Right.
Just, I mean, keep that in mind. There is not one advisor or chief a general that wants to do this at all.
So I think the best place to start is just at the beginning and kind of destruct it forward. Let's start with the chemical attack itself. Or actually, let's start with Obama's statements of red line. So this to me is... It just was such an offhanded, stupid statement of Barack Obama to say that there was a red line. Let's talk about the red line. Should there ever be a point in time where a president says, if this happens, we're going to do this? I mean, he really painted the United States into a corner because he went off teleprompter and said something offhanded.
He was trying to appear strong. And he did the exact opposite. All he's done now is he looks foolish and that he's not respected, and he really holds no influence anywhere outside of our allies. And actually, though, it looks like in Britain he has absolutely no influence whatsoever.
Yeah.
Our greatest ally.
Wait a minute. You don't think that the British response, their boat, you don't think that was just a sign of them saying, we're waiting for the United States to take the lead on this?
No, I think we were taking the lead on it, and they said, go ahead and lead, but we're not following. So let's get to the British here at a later point, but let's talk about the larger question, Creighton, of the red line. I mean, what is the ramifications of speaking off the cuff like this without any kind of coherent foreign policy?
Well, I mean, he never really had a coherent foreign policy. His foreign policy was, you know, let's look tough without... having any kind of goal. I mean, foreign policy obviously is not his, you know, not his area of expertise. I think you're absolutely right. I think he said it to sound tough. I think he probably didn't think that any chemical attacks would ever be used. There was a way, I think he figured it was like just free money almost. He was going to be able to sound tough without ever having to do anything about it. But the ramifications are obvious. It's that now, in order to save face, you know, we have to intervene militarily. I mean, we have to do something.
It is saving face and is a loss or a perceived loss of credibility. I mean, is that any kind of justification for going to war?
Absolutely not. I mean, there is literally no reason for us to intervene in this country right now. I mean, and on the part of an apologist, it's a humanitarian effort, and it's just amazing how the language is nearly identical to Iraq. It's almost the exact same language, but the same people that would have been out in the streets, you know, throwing bricks through windows over Iraq are out here saying, oh, this one's different because it's humanitarian.
No, but, I mean, John Kerry was very outspoken in 2002 about not going into Iraq. He is a famed peace activist. I mean, dating back to
74.
Yeah, when he was in front of Congress, a returning veteran. You know, we all know the famous "I was against it before I was for it," or "I was for it before I was against it." Whatever he said, the flip flop, where he basically voted for the authorization of the funding of the war, but he said in principle he was against that war, and then. The anti-war notion, the anti-war sentiment of Barack Obama is one of the reasons that he endeared himself to especially millennials is because he was so anti-war, so pro-liberty, civil liberties, and it is just stunning to see these guys making this case at this point.
A big part of his appeal when he ran was that we want to restore how we are viewed by the rest of the world. And at the time, I thought there were merits to that. I really did, because we were becoming hated by a lot of different countries, especially in the Middle East and Africa, outside of Kenya. But right now, I think that actually has worked as a negative. We need to take the approach that, you know what, I don't care what anyone thinks. Barack Obama has a chance to save this, in my opinion. If he ignores it, he's going to get hammered on the humanitarian issue of it, but there is no upside by going into Syria, by using a punitive strike. His only option is to ignore it and say, listen, we have to be pragmatic. Sometimes your forced. Sometimes you're forced to deal with the issues at hand and recognize you don't want to.
Yeah, and I think another big thing to remember is that the situation within this compared to Iraq, or really compared to, I think, a lot of previous conflicts that we've been in the Middle East, is that, you know, there are a lot of big powers that, you know, may not necessarily be 100% opposed to us, but this could be the catalyst for setting up a lot of, I mean, for literally causing a domino effect to ignite a larger conflict with very, very, you know, dangerous foreign powers. I mean, Russia obviously being the most prominent. I mean, there are a lot of things that could be done that we could do in Syria that could cause a lot of, you know, a chain of events to take place that lead us down a path that I don't think anybody wants on their resume. You know, Obama doesn't want on his resume that he may have set up the groundwork for a global conflict between industrialized nations like Russia and the United States, or Britain and Russia and the United States, or maybe even China. So, I mean, there is a lot more at stake here than, you know, just a fiasco conflict between America and a Middle Eastern country. I mean,
yes.
There is a lot more nuance to this than Iraq.
Let's get to the chess game here in just a little bit. First, the chemical weapon. I mean, basically how this all began is it was set off by the Arab Spring, and I posted a video on both my personal Facebook and also the Advocates for Self-Government Facebook page, and it explains the entire Syrian conflict in 5 minutes, and it's a very simple, easy-to-understand video. And it outlines the fact that Syria is made up of many, many different tribes. It's an ancient country. I mean, it's, you know, it is part of where isn't Galilee is in Galilee is in Syria.
Yes.
And you know, it is full of hundreds of different tribes, and it's not just an Arab country.
I mean, there's Christians, Jews, Kurds, a whole, and then subsets of all of those.
Right. And it's a very complex country, and the only thing that all of these groups that have in common is that they hate Assad. But Assad has the backing of the Russians and the backing of Iran to maintain power. And the reason we've got here is because those groups tried to step up and throw him out, just like they did with Mubarak in Egypt. And he has such strong military strength, partly because of Hezbollah and
Russia.
And Russia and Iran, because they share a border with Israel and the Golan Heights separates them. It's a very militarized country, because it is a lot of people wanted to militarize that country. So in the event of an attack on Israel, then they would have a nice forward base. So he is able to fight back in a way that Mubarak wasn't able to fight back, because the Egyptian military really was it wasn't a fighting force as much of it was a cultural system. I mean,
yeah.
It was an employer.
Yeah,
it was almost an independent government.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So it's a very complex situation, and we have no clear-cut ally here like we did with Afghanistan, where, if you remember the Northern Alliance, where they're fighting tanks with horses, and they had organized against the Taliban. That doesn't exist here. In fact, the most robust fighting force in Syria currently is essentially a group that has now merged with Al-Qaeda.
Yep.
They've been blessed by Al-Qaeda. They're being given strategic advice by Al-Qaeda. And so our very action in this entire endeavor would be aiding Al-Qaeda. I don't see how that makes any kind of sense whatsoever.
It's bin Laden all over again in Afghanistan.
Completely
right. It is literally a reliving of that.
Only now Afghanistan doesn't share a border with Israel. So, it, you know, just for the same strategic, I mean, we would be giving over Syria to a group that is
completely anti-American.
Assad was anti-American. Assad was anti-Israel, but he also wanted to maintain power. He's a westernized person. He went to school in Britain?
He went to the University of Damascus, and he's an ophthalmologist by training. Learned that in London.
Damn. So,
hey, yeah. Gina, how are you doing?
Good, guys. How are you?
Good. How have you been?
I'm making it, yeah.
Good. High five.
High five.
High five for making it. All right, so...
So Assad is an ophthalmologist?
He's an ophthalmologist.
Ophthalmologist.
Like Rand, he's the Rand Paul of Syria.
Doesn't he look like the kind of guy who would be an ophthalmologist? He doesn't seem like the type of... I mean, he's not like your typical Arab
what
leader.
What does that even mean?
He just doesn't... I mean,
he just looks like an ophthalmologist.
He's always wearing a suit. He's not in all the military garb like Saddam was. He's not... You know, he doesn't wear traditional Bedouin garb like the heads of Saudi Arabia.
He's very Wall Street, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very, like, you know, world banker. And, heck, Pelosi had him over, what, about 3-4 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, and entertain him. Maybe
so we
she
can
should
blame
call
all
him.
This on her. Yeah.
We'll call the great, the Wicked Witch of the West and right. get Assad on the phone. We'll take care of this thing.
I mean, sometimes that's what it takes.
Yeah, you know. But Assad is very proud. That is the thing. Oh. He is very proud. His dad was the leader for 30 years,
yeah.
Declared it a state of emergency that has never left. It's never been lifted, and so he is. For me, what I see is he sees the whole world losing dynasties, losing stability in different regions, and he will not let it happen. And if I was the king of Jordan right now, I'd be crapping my pants.
Well, what is essentially taking place is it is very similar to what happened 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
where you have an entire shift in the way that the world works. I mean, all the old orders are slipping away, and the order of, you know, the Bismarcks of
yeah.
Europe, the kings and the monarchs of Europe, those all vanished into various sorts of democracies. These kingships who overthrew colonial rule, you know, 50 to 80 years ago, are all now in trouble because they have oppressed their people. People have risen up. They're connected through the internet. And that old order is slipping away. And
you know how all that slipped away last time?
How?
World War One.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
then,
was World War One.
And
if we're seeing a shift in power like that, then, I mean, what are the implications in today's world if they have to go the same route?
We've talked on right. past episodes how the Tunisian fruit cart vendor was the Duke Franz Ferdinand moment of this era, and we now have entangling alliances, and unfortunately we are backing Al-Qaeda in Syria, and our opponents, Iran and Russia, are backing Assad. But yeah, the way that it was straightened out in Europe was World War One, and you saw the complete destruction. They finally were exhausted by November 11th, 14. So they created a new world order. It led to a long period of just financial ruin. Hitler rising. And it led to another world war. So I think we are headed towards a Middle Eastern conflict of epic proportions. And the question is, how involved are we going to be in this? This intervention in Syria is not just about dipping your toe into the water to punish Assad. It really is drawing up sides in a conflict that could turn into World War III.
And are we naive enough to think that we can continue going around and, I guess, asserting our own agenda on other places and expect not to be attacked on our own soil?
Has there really been a clear example of America trying to play policeman of the world in our lifetime?
That's debatable, but there are certainly cultures who teach their children that we have.
Right.
Oh, definitely in, like, Georgia. I mean, that would be the number one example. I would, you know, where Bush had a great relationship and essentially kept
not,
him.
Not like Atlanta, Georgia, but
no,
like Georgia,
not the South. Not the
yeah.
South.
I think a lot of this has to do with, like, for majority of the post-World War II era, you know, it was always, you know, we would intervene in all these Middle Eastern countries and African countries. It would just be like satellite conflicts between the United States and Russia. So there was always these two other outlying forces kind of containing all of it because they had a larger conflict between each other. As the Cold War has ended and the Soviet Union has fallen, I think we're starting to see the effects of having of essentially not changing the game plan on how we deal with all these other countries, but without the other effect of having a large power like the Soviet Union, you know, to oppose. And we have all these other countries that are essentially living under, you know, the same kind of paradigm that they had during the Cold War as far as they're concerned with us, because we're still doing things in their country. We're still setting up and we're still aiding some tribe at the expense of another and helping out this group at the expense of this group, essentially trying to play puppet to overthrow some regime or something. You know, that's, we did that throughout all, we did that a ton during the Cold War. We never really stopped. But now there is no Soviet Union. And I think, you know, the rest of the, I think the Middle Eastern world is kind of like, dude, I mean, we're people too. You know, we're a country.
It's a direct,
you know,
quote.
Why should we have to deal with this crap? You know, these are people that you put into power, and there is no argument against Soviet Union anymore. I mean, now, you know, you put these people into power and they're freaking killing us. And it's like, you know, it's a totally, I think a lot of it has to do with just like our foreign policy in a sense has never really changed since the Cold War. And this is the effect of that foreign policy when you don't have two nuclear powered countries ready to blow the world up, always fighting each other.
Constantly, yeah.
I actually think there might be something a little deeper going on here, in that I think we're seeing, I mean, there's always been a clash between Western-style liberalism and Islamic culture. Always has been, always will be. However, I think we're seeing the rise of like an Islamo-fascism as an ideology that is transnational. And so maybe the Soviet Union versus the United States isn't the right comparison. Maybe it might be something. Look at the entire continent of Africa. That is an entire continent that might be susceptible to Islamic republics. You are seeing it in the Sudan. You're seeing it in Morocco. You see it in Libya, Egypt. Granted, there was a coup/revolution, but that doesn't mean it couldn't fall back into that. When you have a group, essentially the Arab League, of Islamic republics and Sharia law as the standard for all legal reasoning versus Western-style liberalism of democracy, that might be the unformed Soviet Union of the Cold War, an Islamo-fascist country that is formed of satellites, and that could be, this might be World War One. The next one would be World War Two when they're organized.
Be between the two, yeah. I mean, and that's very
terrifying.
Astute. Terrifying, because it isn't. The Nazis were horrific. But in the way that they fought the war, there was a standard in World War II of the way that the two sides fought. There isn't that sort of standard in the battlefields of the war on terror, let's call it. I mean, and that, I think, is what drives so many people into hiding in these countries, is the fact that they are being oppressed by a very small minority of their own society. They beheaded
two Christian bishops today in
right,
northern
in Syria.
I mean, and that was the rebels. That wasn't even Assad.
Right. So yeah. it really is terrifying. And I think
what was the reasoning behind that?
Because they were labeled pro Assad, and so they were also Christians, and so they beheaded them publicly and took a YouTube video of it.
Yeah.
Sad.
And posted the YouTube. I mean, yeah. It really is terrifying, and I think that there is a strong part of... So here's the question, and we'll start with Creighton next. The neoconservatives say, well, we need to intervene in places like Syria so we can... I guess if we were on Assad's side, it might make some sense, but we're on Al-Qaeda's side. We're fighting for the nut jobs. In Egypt, we're on the side of the Muslim Brotherhood. We're not on the side of, you know, the Mubarak regime. These old strongmen who kept the region, you know, somewhat stabilized, and just kind of did our bidding for a long time. Now, I don't know that we know what side we're on. We just feel like we need to lob bombs in the middle of it. But if Greg is looking at the region and saying, this is World War One, as they come together to form their Islamo-fascist state, their caliphate, essentially, how do we as non-interventionists deal with that, Creighton?
I couldn't tell you, honestly. I mean, I think a big problem with the whole situation is that, you know, in World War One and World War Two, we had, you know, actual nation states that were fighting each other. In this one, we would not. We would have, you know, and we would have guerrilla warfare. It'd essentially be Vietnam on a global scale.
Which did not go well for us.
So I don't know. I mean, as non-interventionists, you basically are faced with the option of, you know, will we make things better by going in, or will we I mean, if you ignore the legal, the constitutional aspects of it, is like, is the outcome going to be better or worse? I don't think there is going to be a better outcome, because, you know, you solve one problem and a million different ones pop up out of it. So, I mean, it's not like we're going to be able to go in and trample Assad's regime and put one of our guys in place, because all he's going to do is get revolted against too. I mean, it's obvious that these Muslim countries don't care exactly who's in power. They care about the situation they're in, and we have a track record of putting people in who are dictators and are tyrannical. So, honestly, I don't know. I think the best route to take, from the perspective I'm looking at, is to allow them to deal with what they're doing and see how it turns out. Even if we ever did intervene, this isn't the moment. You know, I don't think we should, but this isn't the moment that we should step in and intervene, because, I mean, like you said, we don't even know who the heck we're standing up for.
Right, and part of the problem with intervention, and here's why non-interventionists believe what we do, this is a story from the Daily Mirror out in the United Kingdom today. Syria is using human shields, and President Assad is moving prisoners to military targets. They are unloading the prisons, putting them into buses, and driving them to strategic targets. This is something that Saddam did in Iraq, and this is also against all international laws.
Against common decency. It's against
horrific.
Everything.
Yeah.
And this is just an average Syrian woman who was interviewed said this. One woman said, "People are scared the U.S. will attack the places where the prisoners are held. These prisoners are not like murderers, or, I mean, maybe most of them are probably political dissidents. They're people who disagree with Assad. They are afraid as military bases are in built-up areas, so civilians may be caught in attacks. They have seen the civilians killed by U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan." And that is the problem with intervention. As we intervene in these countries and we try to dictate the order in these countries, we kill their citizens in the process. We create enemies of the main street of these countries, and at the same time, we support people who oppress them, and we enable people who we supposedly think like we do, which we don't like our own government. Congress has a 9% approval rating. Why would we think that if they can't fix our healthcare, they can fix Afghanistan or Syria?
It's an absolutely crazy assumption that we are capable of going in there, finding the individuals who are even capable of leading a Western-style democracy, or at least a parliamentary style, that are committed to basic human rights. I'm not sure more than 100 people even exist that believe like that in any major Middle Eastern country.
We haven't been able to do it in Iraq. Iraq is in free fall at the moment. Afghanistan, Karzai is an absolute loon. I mean, he's an insane person.
Yeah.
And we keep supporting him. We're supporting the corruption of the Afghani police force, which oppresses people on a local level. Like, we sit here and complain with cop block and police oppression and police brutality.
Right.
It doesn't even hold a candle to what we're supporting in other nations.
No.
That's why intervention doesn't work, because instead of them turning their ire on the people that are oppressing them and being self-reliant and self-sufficient and building a democracy the way that our founding fathers did, they blame us. They blame the Western countries.
Right, but our founding fathers kind of had a different set of circumstances. They were in the middle of usurping land that they felt that their destiny had manifested for their behalf.
They were in a better situation, because all they were doing was quartering troops. I mean, and there was the Boston Massacre. That is the violent incident that stands out.
Their opponent was also across the ocean.
Exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, whereas in... there's no real opponent over there. I mean, Britain. Well,
whoever is releasing the chemical weapons is obviously an opponent of the people.
But who released the chemical weapons? Can we sit here and say for sure?
Nope.
That who released the chemical weapons?
Nope.
Nope. There is. I mean, Rand Paul said it today at Campbellsville, today or yesterday at Campbellsville University. He goes, "It makes no sense for Assad to use chemical weapons because he said, you know, he said qui bono. So who benefits?
Right.
He goes, he has the entire world looking at him now, thinking about coming after him. If his whole reason for doing this is to preserve his role within Syria, you don't do it. You absolutely do not do it.
Yeah, and we'll go to Creighton here in just a second. Assad is a guy who wants to maintain power, and they have drawn a red line in the sand and said that action will be taken if chemical weapons are used. And what, in my mind, it doesn't make sense that Assad would use chemical weapons in such a definitive way. There are reports that maybe it's his brother. His brother is an insane person. He's the barber, the barbarous person over there. He's the butcher. You know,
he's the one that they had pictures of him at the site of the chemical.
Right.
Yeah, the chemical weapon usage.
So you really don't have hard evidence on who did this. You know, Ron Paul falsely is being he said it's a false flag. So they're saying that it's a conspiracy, but that's not what he meant. He meant that. We don't know who it was. It could have been the Al-Qaeda insurgents who did this to draw America into the conflict to help them defeat an enemy who is winning. Assad was winning. Why would he want to draw the United States into this war when he is maintaining his power after 2.5 years?
Yeah, unless it's a Gulf of Tonkin type thing where they, you know, where the U.S. wanted to be involved or Al-Qaeda wanted to get us involved by getting us on their side. I do not see a positive outcome for a single party involved other than the rebels. That's it.
Right, but at that, like, what positive outcome has come out of the rest of the senseless slaughter that's been going on that we assume is Assad?
Uniting against... Well, the thing to remember about Assad is he's an Alawist. They're only 12%...
Right. Alawite.
Alawite. They're only 12% of the Muslim population there. They're a very small segment of it. And whereas the Muslim Brotherhood is very good at merging Sunni and Shias. And so if they can ignite enough support between the two in Syria, they can look at establishing a functional – I mean, realistically, democracy is a dangerous thing to promote there because if we had an Islamic Democratic Republic in Egypt, we could be on the exact same path in Syria if we support the rebels and they win. And then you're sitting there saying, what the heck was this for?
Right.
I mean – you have to be very careful about supporting democracy. We should really be promoting constitutional republic type of
governance. Hitler was elected with 36% of the vote.
He didn't do anything illegal.
Right.
He did a bunch of things morally wrong, but he didn't do a single thing illegal.
Right. Creighton, why don't you weigh in here? I know you've got something to say.
Well, I think the big question I have is, you know, everyone's assuming that Assad is the one who dropped the chemical weapons. What if we find out it was the rebels? It was a rebel group. You know, what response do we have to that? What response would the United States have if they found out unequivocally that it was actually a rebel group that detonated these chemical weapons? What does that red line in the sand mean at that point? Does that mean that we start supporting Assad against the, I mean, is that like our entire situation, our stance on this entire war is dependent upon the method it was taken? Or do you think that Obama's going to completely backtrack and say, you know what, the red line didn't mean anything?
We did it in Egypt. We backed Mubarak, and then we backed the Muslim Brotherhood. We just kind of went along. I mean, Cameron is being blamed for looking like a fool because he lost the vote. I don't mind if Barack Obama looks like an absolute fool. I mean, you're a former Obama supporter. I mean, do you have a problem with him losing face if he steps back from the brink of going to Syria?
I think as long as the smartest decision is made, I don't care about his face. You know, does that make sense? Like, I don't care about his reputation. I don't care about his ratings, so long as we make the right decision for the right reasons.
Right. Good policy. And one offhanded comment doesn't make a policy.
Right.
There's a way to do it, too, without appearing aloof or unengaged, where you say, listen, ultimately, there is no one we can support with our full faith and confidence. Therefore, we are going to move on to bigger and more important issues for the United States, especially domestically, and start to rewrite foreign policy and be the first president to take that stance toward non-interventionism.
He could embrace what he won on, and he could embrace what he promised to the American people, which is, you know, moving towards non-interventionism. I mean, he's certainly not
a
non-interventionist.
And what does he have to lose?
What? 70% of Americans are against this strike.
Yeah, well, I mean, what does he have to lose by going back to what he stood for in his campaign?
Or what he did in
Libya. It's not like he's risking getting reelected or something. I mean, honestly, what could his possible motivation be to be, you know, to give so many inclinations that he is such as much of a war hawk as a McCain would be? You know, I mean, what possible, I mean, I'm literally just thinking out loud, what possible incentives could he have
financial,
other than he just never
financial.
Believed it in the first place?
I'll tell you,
it's always finances. It's always money.
I think he desperately does not want to do this. I think it is extremely telling that a president of the United States is leading us to a war, and the most that he has said about this is a few lines on NewsHour a few nights ago on PBS, which how many viewers does NewsHour on PBS get? And then he gave a very small briefing today at 2:15 in the cabinet room with the cabinet around him. The rest of the case has been made by John Kerry. Kerry looks more presidential than Barack Obama right now. There is no leadership from Barack Obama whatsoever. To show that they were making the case, the White House put out the call log for the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state and Samantha Power, the head of the UN. Barack Obama has made one phone call every day to a foreign leader, to his counterpart. He called the Australian Prime Minister, then the next day, the Great Britain Prime Minister, then the next day, Hollande in France. That is the extent of the phones that he's worked. Biden, the same thing. Kerry and Samantha Power have called everyone under the sun, including Russia and Iran and other places, to make this happen. Barack Obama has not lifted a finger to make the case to anyone.
I'll tell you, though, Joe Biden is the one with all the relationships. He sat as the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for, what, 12 years?
Right.
I mean, he is a highly connected individual, especially when it comes to things like this.
He has the bully pulpit. 70% of the country does not want to do this. The Congress, the reason they're not calling Congress back to vote, okay, there's nothing legal about this strike. The UN is not going to take a vote because it would be blocked by Russia, so it will be illegal. And isn't it funny that the UN was set up to prevent wars, and now it is the decider of when we're going to war?
Right.
It is now
the
a
decider.
Now it
the
is
strategist.
A right. It is a war body. NATO says they're not even going to take up a discussion on this. NATO was involved in Iraq. The Joint Chiefs are against it. Chuck Hagel said, the most that Chuck Hagel has said, who is, by and large, a dove, said, well, we'll be ready if that's what the president wants. The military is leaking
to the Washington Post.
To the Washington Post that they don't want to do this. If they called Congress back, Barack Obama would lose a vote on this. If you're the president of the United States and you don't want to lose face by not doing this, why would you want to lose face by not fighting for a policy, not fighting for a war that you supposedly believe in?
I do not have a good answer, unless there is something that if there is like some corner that we don't know about that he's backed into as far as a commitment on this, I have no idea why he's acting the way he is, because that honestly is the only conclusion I can reach.
Honestly, if you think about, was it Libya where he waited for the UN? It was like kind of historic. The United States generally doesn't.
The Arab League supported it. I think the Arab League is supporting this, or they're lending some moral support to this. But yeah, the Arab League basically is, they were the ones who said go ahead in Libya.
Okay. But we waited for some sort of, not global consensus, but global feedback. And that, to me, is his modus operandi, and this, to me, is out of character. So, like you're saying, how could his back be up against the wall? What corner could he be pushed into? Clearly,
what do we not know about?
Exactly. Clearly, there's something that we don't know about, because he has operated in a particular manner up until this point.
Yeah, I mean, he has...
Could it possibly just be that he's trying to secure his legacy somehow? I mean...
But securing his legacy would be, in my opinion, like preserving the manner in which he was operating before. To me, it would be a more favorable legacy on his behalf to have helped the United States avoid war than to have jumped into wars without.
Yeah, to be the guy who said in 2002 that he does not support dumb wars. I mean, everything that he said in that speech in 2002 about Iraq – is exactly what's taking place here. I just don't, for the life of me, there's just no answers. There's no strategic sense to it. They tried to say today, John Kerry tried to make the case that, you know, we had hard evidence and that this is a national security issue. That if we don't go in, then we will give Assad the likelihood of using it again. Well, let's refute that argument. You are basically telling him in your speech, John Kerry, and by the leaks that we are hearing from all corners, that this is going to be just muscular enough for us not to lose face. So you're telling Assad that he can use chemical weapons and then take 8 days to move all of his chemical weapons, then you will blow something up that probably, like when we struck the what was the factory that we struck in Iraq that... like a pencil factory.
Yeah, it was a pencil factory.
It was a pencil factory in Baghdad,
outside of Baghdad.
And then we're not going to do anything else. It's going to be a one-time deal where we're going to punish you by blowing up an airfield, and then that's it.
That is the thing. What is the virtue of a proportional response? War is absolutely horrible. The only way to prevent it is it for it to be absolutely horrible without it being transactional. You do this, you gas your people, the world community is going to take out a few strategic military instruments. That is insane. It needs to be... I would tend towards non-interventionism, but
You're the hawkish person.
Yeah,
here.
Like, I am completely believe in non-intervention policy, but at the same time, I believe that if you hit me once, I will hit you so hard, no one would ever do it again. Because this is what happens when Brock goes to Cairo University and says, if you will just unclench your fist and talk to us and build a relationship, it's been nothing but catastrophe. We have not been feared. There have been no repercussions for any of this, for the atrocious crimes on women, children, chemical gassing. If you're going to be a moral leader, which we really don't have much credibility for that either after Iraq, you better be prepared that when people do cross red lines, you hammer the hell out of them.
Yeah. I mean, when he gave that Cairo speech, it was a tide turner. And it really was an impetus for some of the currents of the Arab Spring. It wasn't a cause, but it certainly made the Arab Street, feel that if we rise up, then the United States is not going to be against the people living inside these countries. And then the first warning sign came with the Green Revolution in Iran, where we did nothing. We didn't do. We completely stayed out of it. You know, so if you're a moral leader like Barack Obama, then you do something to help overthrow Iran, which is the only country at this point that we have not bombed or invaded without a declaration of war. I mean, we just invade every single country, every single airspace with drones. And the drones are really the erosion of his moral authority. One, completely screwing up the moral situation in Egypt by just staying on the sidelines. And then drones invading, you know, sovereign airspace and killing innocent people with drones.
Yep.
And
American citizens in Yemen. I mean,
he lost every shred of credibility and moral.
Not shutting down Guantanamo.
If he wanted to, that stuff is his legacy. That is the legacy that he could have had by just staying out. I don't know.
But non-intervention has got to be, you still regardless have to be feared, because
right.
If you get the label as non-intervention, then they say, listen, realistically it's going to take something really big to get them off the fence or off the bench into this game. We're just going to just do what we want. You know, it's Hitler.
Right.
It's when he went to Munich and Neville Chamberlain gave him everything he wanted to. He said, we're not going to expand, and then they march into Paris, and then they keep coming and coming and coming. You have to hit the hell out of someone.
But in Egypt, it's as soon as the Arab Spring starts, you withdraw military funding, and you completely weaken the position of Mubarak. And you say, he is your dictator no longer, thank you, courtesy of the United States.
But you will not get a dime of support out of us if you install a Sharia quote-unquote democracy like they ended up doing regardless. Because that's dictator or Muslim Brotherhood leadership. Who cares?
We return to the foreign policy that we had before Ronald Reagan. Up until Ronald Reagan, our foreign policy was, if you abuse women, if you are a tyrannical dictatorship, if you are terrible on human rights, if you have a human rights abuse, then we will no longer support you. But you will not get a dime of aid from us. Reagan gets in, he says, okay, we're now going to fight the Soviets and use foreign policy as a tool. And starts funding people like Osama bin Laden. And Saddam Hussein, and then look where we were at 20 years later.
You create your own enemies by intervening when you probably shouldn't. I mean, you really do. But there is an issue that if you – is it okay to ignore crimes and violence, humanitarian violations?
Yeah.
I mean, quite frankly, Sudan, we would be way more justified if it's a humanitarian issue by going into Sudan right now.
Truth.
Way more than Syria.
The Congo.
1,400 people compared to what? 25,000 Christians,
right.
Women, children, slaughtered with machetes, not gas.
Yeah, the Congo is in horrific civil war. We're not intervening there. I mean, what is the line? I mean, sarin gas is obviously terrible, and the fact that it was used to kill
women and children
is despicable.
Is despicable and horrific, but women and children are killed with bombs and other conventional tools of weapons. I mean, What makes gas some sort of special red line?
It
is
shouldn't.
Barbaric, though.
Right.
No,
not that any of them are kind ways to kill people.
No, for me, I mean, if I'm Barack Obama, I say, you know what? It's no big deal, and I brush it off, and then I order drone strikes. So I make Assad feel comfortable. I make him not move political dissidents to protect him, and then I just absolutely obliterate his entire government operational system. All of his military fields, and when you do it silently, you do it with drones, and then you're in and out. I mean, that may be a horrible way to fight war, but if you're going to break the... Once you're outside the law, you live there. We're going to meet you out
there. I mean, there is no international law, though.
Yeah, in reality, there's moral and there's immoral.
There is an international treaty that outlaws the use of chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction. Assad and Syria have not signed that treaty.
And there... Yep, so... So in reality, there's what a country can do and there's what a country can't do. I mean, if they're not bound by the same laws as us, let's live outside the law. You want to walk that line?
I mean, just the basic core of the globe, there is no global set of laws or codes. There are a handful of treaties that help establish rules and guidelines, or basically the basic structure of... You know,
a framework.
A framework of you cross this line and we will bomb you, essentially, is what we have. But it's really more a series of threats than actual laws.
So what would you say... Here's my point that I was going to make. This pisses me off. Like, there are a few things, like, Econ bores the crap out of me, I'm sorry. Reading Rothbard, not my idea of a good time in Friday night. I enjoy foreign policy, but I do not enjoy this. This makes me miserable. This... pisses me off.
It's because the solution is so non... There is no solution. There is no evident solution.
Do you think that I'm happy about saying we should do nothing?
Right. Well, our options are stand by and watch people be slaughtered or hop into World War III. I mean...
There's just no good option there. I mean, it's... And George Packer...
But, you know, that was our situation in World War II.
Right.
Set by and watch people be slaughtered or jump into World War II.
No, we try to negotiate. I mean...
Well, I'm sure
I mean, yeah. Well, I don't know. Have they? I mean, I don't feel like any diplomatic things have been pursued whatsoever.
They haven't been publicized.
Yeah.
Because the Russians block everything at the UN Security Council. The Russians are backing them. So are
the Chinese.
Right.
Okay, so when we're in a situation when the Russians and Chinese are both backing someone not to negotiate.
And Iran.
Yeah, okay.
All three. Iran is really the prime driver of all this.
How about the Kim Jongs? Where are they standing on this?
They're... busy torturing some poor
ex-girlfriends.
So
in front of their families and then sending them off to death camps.
I think a lot of this has to do not with the drawing us into a war, but what does it look like on the other side? Russia and China, especially Russia, look really good right now. They have used this incident to start to draw themselves into superpower status globally. As we decline on the world stage, they're trying to assert their influence in
Snowden.
Various ways. Yep.
Snowden, and then realistically, they right now are the Chinese greatest supplier of oil. And so that they're the world's largest oil and refiner and producer. I just said global anyway. But yeah, so China isn't going to do anything that's going to hurt them economically. They are agnostic. What is good for us for financially is what we will pursue.
Right.
The problem is the Chinese, by pursuing this in the long run, are going to be up a creek, because there is going to be a time when they're going to be expected to influence events globally, and they will not put up with this kind of stuff. They will not put up with dissidents, Islamic dissidents, anything like that. They will – heck, they're Tiananmen Square. They will roll you over with tanks and black bag you and then be like, what's next?
So will Russia. I mean, Russia is
– but isn't that what we're concerned about with the Islamic states? I mean, it's all some level of
– realistically, your best choice is stability. Realistically.
One of the world's largest reserves of oil sits under the Caspian Sea. And that is why Vladimir Putin and the Russians have – wholesale slaughtered Chechnya, and that is why there is fighting in Chechnya, is because they want access to that Caspian Sea reserves. And it's curious that they would get involved in the Syrian, and I think maybe that's partly why they want to keep the strongman model of government in the Middle East, is because they don't want that domino to fall. So there is a caliphate, because that would be bad for the Russians.
Very much so.
Then they can't get to the Caspian Sea oil.
There will become ultimately a Assad will fall. There's no way that he doesn't eventually. Is it within the next 10 or, you know, year, 2, 3 years? Maybe, maybe not. But eventually.
Well, I mean, he's a legacy, right?
Yep. His dad was the dad was the president for 30 years. We tried to support a coup against his dad through the CIA that ultimately failed.
So, I mean, there is a way.
Yeah, there is a way. And he's. But ultimately, it's going to be a – all these countries are going to end up being Islamic republics. Not now, maybe not 10 years, but eventually. It's happening. It absolutely is going to happen, because they will not tolerate this tradition of little mini kingdoms. It's not going to work. People – with the world the way it is, with the internet, information widely available, you are looking at democratic Islamic republics for quite some time.
So the Constitution says that a declaration must be made. The War Powers Act expands that for the president to act when national security is at risk, and you can go in for 60 days and act. Obama really stretched it with Libya.
Right.
It wasn't really covered under the War Powers Act.
Right.
And he stayed past 60 days. I'm not even sure if we're out of there or not. I mean, has anybody heard?
I know. There's no way we're out of there yet.
So...
That's the reason that we intervene so often, is that to clean up our own mess is so fiscally beneficial to us. Like, we benefit from that financially when we stick around to clean up our own mess, which is, honestly, I think that's a good part of the reason why we so seldom wait for the UN. Because once it becomes a UN endeavor, it's the UN stands to make that money cleaning up their own mess.
Oh, and at the end of the day, 90% of UN funding is United States.
Right.
So he who has the gold card makes the rules. You know, right. that's the way it is. The UN is nothing more than something that, I guess, it's something for global humanitarians to feel good about.
Roosevelt's legacy.
Yeah, at the end of the day, a country's going to do what it wants to do, and if you're as powerful as the United States military, there's no one that's going to oppose you.
Right. Mm. So my question is, going into Syria, they don't call back Congress for any kind of discussion or authorization of money, because we certainly can't afford it. It's not allocated in the budget. Those missiles that we're going to shoot are expensive. But they know that they'd probably lose the vote if they called them back. So he is superseding the Constitution once again. He's ignoring the law. He's ignoring the law of... the international system, of the War Powers Act that was passed in the 70s.
This was discussed by the Federalist Papers. James Madison wrote, "The reason we're placing the ability to declare war with Congress is because the executive branch is the most likely to declare it." They specifically waited for something like this, and that's why it's designed the way it is. And ultimately what happens, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
It's an imperialist presidency at this point. You know, I'm not an impeachment person. It's one of those things that people always throw around and say, oh, well, we got to impeach him. It's like, well, we did it to Clinton, so they had to do it to Bush, and now we got to do it to Obama, and then we're going to do it to the next guy.
It's like hazing and graduation day in a fraternity.
Yeah, it's a tradition that in the second term, second year, you got to start calling for impeachment. But to me, there is nothing more serious than going to war. War is... the foundations of libertarian principles are, you know, the value of production, of voluntary relationships,
natural harmony,
natural harmony, spontaneous order, individualism. War erases limited government. War erases all of that. War destroys everything. It destroys human life. It destroys capital. It destroys everything.
It's because we've cheapened it.
Right.
We fight these extended wars where it's, oh, well, we're kind of committed. We're kind of not. We're kind of going to go in. World War One and World War Two were absolutely devastating, monstrous commitments.
Right.
Now it is, we're going to fight this thing from virtual reality offices with drones. Right. We're going to, you know, and essentially the U.S. military can go in, set up a perimeter, and be relatively safe on a casualty, you know, from a casualty count for an extended period of time. That is not what war is designed for.
Right.
War is to go in and devastate someone so that no one, it's to make an example of anyone that was thinking about doing the same thing.
Yeah. According to the Pew, if I remember the numbers correctly, I may not be spot on, but if you download the podcast of a speech that I gave on the Chris Spangle Show, you can find it at wal-radio.com about millennials in politics and libertarians' attraction to libertarianism. 24% of the greatest generation served in World War II were in the military. 17% of the baby boomers, and then it dropped down in the Gen Xers to like 6%, and now in the millennials, which is bigger than the baby boomer generation, 2% serve in the military. So there is a very limited amount of us that serve in the military, and it's just not a part of our culture.
And it's not necessary. That's the other part. I mean, it is not nearly as necessary to put people on the ground.
Nope. So war is the most serious of all the things that the state can do. Is this impeachable?
Oh, absolutely. If we're in there over 60 days, it's an impeachable offense unless Congress gives him the go-ahead for a drawdown plan and funds for that. Anything more than that that Congress isn't willing to adhere to, it's an impeachable offense.
It's interesting, though, because as we mentioned earlier, Kerry is kind of the face of it, and Obama appears to be dragging his feet and you know, dragging ass, really.
It's almost like he doesn't want to put his face on TV with a bad policy.
Well, yeah. But it also appears as though he doesn't agree with a bad policy, so who's really making the calls? Like, if he's the one who gets impeached over a call that he clearly did not want to make, or apparently did not want to make, it would be a sad situation, in my opinion, just because of the way that Kerry has been the spearhead for the entire...
Yeah, the buck stops with Obama. He's the commander-in-chief. Secretary of State is third in line, but I mean they're
well, yeah, so he's got to make the call.
Yeah, I mean
they're the agent. They're right. The one, when the president can't be politically affiliated with a bad guy, that the Secretary of State can work through back channels and get information.
Right.
You know, but for Barack Obama, this is devastating. I mean, I always had concerns. He struck me as a guy that had never put himself on the line for anything. He had gone to college. He'd done well. Did relatively well.
He's a smart individual.
Yeah. But everything he did was something where, I guess, it was expected. I felt like he never really put himself on the line and took a risk. Like his first election, his political godfather made sure that his running mate wasn't on the ticket. They got her off of there so he could win unopposed. And I don't feel comfortable with someone that's never failed. That's never looked failure in the face and had to deal with it and come back from that.
Yeah, it's one of your most powerful learning resources.
Exactly. And right now, I feel like he is suffering the consequences of never being a failure, and it's showing up in spades.
One of the complaints about Bush is that he's so sure of himself.
Oh,
he failed a lot, man. He failed a bunch.
He was a giant failure.
But, I mean, like, even before politics, he was a huge failure.
Right. That's what we're saying.
Yeah. Drunk, you know, I mean, just tons of failure.
Tying his shoes was a difficult task.
Right, but he was sure of himself. He was sure of what he was doing, and he had his style where he would get people around the table, hear the ideas, and then say, okay, let's do it. And, hey, the buck stops with me. If it's a mistake, it's a mistake. You know, he didn't – while he was – I think that eventually one day he will come out and say that Iraq was a huge mistake.
Oh, for sure.
100% before he passes away.
Right after he cashes the checks from Halliburton.
He got named an evil man, but at his core, that's not.
You're sure?
That's Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure Bush didn't receive a dime.
I'd
no, he was
he
a failed
did.
Oil man. He ran an oil company right into the ground.
And he was able to just barely unload it for its asset value.
Right.
And then gets like a quarter of a percent of the Rangers and then a seat on the board.
And then he ran the Rangers into the ground and then they kicked him out.
No one will ever convince me that his pockets weren't lined by the activities.
Well, he couldn't because they were in a trust. So
oh,
when he was
yeah,
governor
no,
and
couldn't.
Then...
No, the presidency makes you a rich man because as soon as you're out, then you can go speak to Halliburton for $200,000 an hour, and Obama will do it
right,
too.
But you can also create an organization. You can name your children as chair people. You can funnel your money through.
It
that.
Has to be a blind trust. It has to be managed
now,
by someone else.
To,
there's
to
all
what
kinds
Gina
of
is,
ways to
do
it, Greg.
What
I've
Gina
seen it go
is
down
saying
a lot.
Is there is a location. If you watch the documentary about water on Netflix, mm-hmm. the Bushes have like this one secret place in Costa Rica or something that is like the largest source of fresh water. In this hemisphere.
Yeah. Gina was not even aware of that.
Yeah, and the...
so that is not what she was
saying. That goes back to Prescott.
The head of the nonprofit are his two daughters.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, big shock. I mean,
right.
a lot of millionaires, a lot of people with a great amount of money...
Invested interest.
...set up almost like a dummy corporation, name their children as shareholders, and they're able to avoid a lot of tax burdens that way.
Hey...
Rewrite the tax code.
All I'm saying is I guarantee you there's some kind of dummy organization somewhere that is collecting money that is a direct result of things that we did in Iran and Afghanistan where Bush is benefiting. I guarantee you.
Yeah, there's probably a Cayman Island shell corporation that holds a whole bunch of stock in private contractors
somewhere.
I'm sure
that Obama... I mean, it goes both ways. It's just... It's not a Republican-Democrat thing.
It's a politically connected thing.
I'm just saying that the man is cashing checks based upon the, quote, poor decisions that he made.
Right. So...
That will eventually be declared a mistake.
But he's... Everybody was after him to... At this point in his presidency, everybody was after him to admit a mistake. Have you heard anybody going after Obama trying to get him to admit to a mistake?
Well, no, it's victimhood presidency.
I guess maybe the press, you know, but at this point in the year, JFK in 1963, I think it was, had done 19 press conferences, sit-down press conferences with the press.
Oh, he used to go in there.
Right.
They're on YouTube. They're epic.
The last time that Obama had a press conference or an informal conversation with the press was 3.5 years ago. The only people that he will talk to at this point really are it's been 3.5 years since he's talked to anyone in the White House press corps.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the fact was. He's very unwilling to sit down with the press. Now, he'll sit down with NewsHour at PBS because he gets the 11 minutes.
He'll sit down with Leno.
Right. Yeah.
Historically a hard questioner, although I guess it was David Brooks that got Nixon to admit Watergate.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's what I was thinking about the other day. I don't know if you have ever heard this about Nixon. When Nixon was president and he was worried about, you know, obviously he's worried about Russia, he let it slip through one advisor that he trusted that he was in the early stages of dementia and that he was a little crazy and that every day they weren't sure if he was going to make a decision about, essentially nuclear war.
Nixon or Reagan?
No, Nixon.
Wow.
I know. He let it slip that he was mentally unstable. And I can't remember if it was exactly dementia, but that he was mentally unstable and they were really concerned. One senior advisor let it leak to the press back to the Russians, and it scared the Russians crapless that there's this president of the United States with the ability to declare nuclear war.
And dementia.
And he's not always remembering his name, and he's very angry some days, and he's not other days. And it ended up being brilliant, because as paranoid as he was and as mentally complicated as he was absolutely probably one of the smartest presidents we've ever had.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Nixon read the biography of Nixon, one of the most complex, weird, smartest people you'll ever... I mean, he's
chief of staff under... not chief of staff, or maybe deputy chief of staff at like 31.
Right.
That's incredible. I mean, vice president under Eisenhower.
And he was
young.
Are
you kidding me?
Yeah,
like 38.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Damn. He was a wonder kid. But just was an absolute psycho.
Yeah, but where is that type of bluff is, I guess, what I'm asking. Where is that... If I'm President Obama, I have absolutely nothing to lose than letting it leak... that I am so angry at these civil rights violations that I am establishing a new U.S. doctrine of any humanitarian thing
doctrine
like this.
Of whoop ass.
Yeah, and it's not just gonna be country building. We're just going to and it's not gonna involve troops. We're gonna send over our carriers and we are gonna drone you for 100 days.
Well,
drones and dogs,
and we don't care. And we do not care if it hits civilians. We are so tired of this crap. We're going to make you the example.
Samantha Power is the spearhead of the responsibility to protect doctrine. It is certainly something that should be looked up on Wikipedia and read about. Samantha Power is the ambassador to the United Nations now, and she crafted a doctrine called the responsibility to protect doctrine, where essentially the old world order. No longer applies. Okay, the United States is so important in the world and is such an important figure and has so many resources that we have to redistribute our bombs to the people who are inflicting harm on their civilians, on their people, and that we have a responsibility to intervene in places like Sudan and in Syria, in Iraq, where these massive genocides are taking place. It is our responsibility to protect their citizens. Nationalism no longer applies. You are the world's policeman, so act like it. And she just named essentially what the view is.
Yeah.
So
that's a tough thing to sell to a U.S. citizenry, realistically, don't you believe? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that you could run on that ever. If that's your foreign policy view, that if there is a humanitarian cause being violated, we will intervene regardless 100% of the time. That's the trigger.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think?
I think any kind of blind policy along those lines is a poor decision. Obviously, humanitarian atrocities are egregious, and we need to keep them to a minimum. Or they need to be kept to a minimum, but I don't know that it's our place.
Our responsibility or our place?
Both. I don't know if we have a responsibility or an obligation.
And we don't have the budget.
No. That's the reality.
I mean, I'm not the budget, our defense budget is so ridiculously high because we build war machines that the cost to actually use them, yes, would probably be crippling. And right. So we obviously need to adjust that because we're spending foolishly as a nation. But that being said, you know, even beyond the finances, like you mentioned in the article where they're using these civilians as human shields, there is no way to go in and protect people while killing them.
Sure, you say you're not going to get
fight
involved
for peace. You cannot.
You say you're not going to get involved. I mean, it's chess, and you say, listen. If you're President Obama, and he's going to get hammered by it in the press if he did this, but you bluff and you say, we're not going to get involved. Quite frankly, the United States has to be pragmatic about the affairs it gets itself entangled in. You let Assad get comfortable, and then you do it silently, you do it quickly, and you do it absolutely to remove him from power. But then, is it really a humanitarian...
But you do what? You take out a bunch of civilians trying to get to him?
No, because once you let him get comfortable, he's going to go right back to standard operating procedure, and then you hit... Every Capitol building, we have the NSA and the CIA, between the two of them, if we put their heads together, they're going to get some decent data on where
he's,
he is.
He's already probably moved the majority of these chemical weapons and the majority of his machinery into Iran. Mm. And we're certainly not going to go into Iran and strike his equipment inside Iran. I mean, that's insanity. So we've given him an 8-day lead to start organizing his affairs. Mm-hmm. You know, if your mom is coming over and you know she knows where your pot is, are you going to leave it out?
Nope.
You know, you're going to hide your pot.
Especially not if I've got
an 8-day.
I'm
going to smoke it.
Right.
Especially not if I got an 8-day lead.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You got 8 days to find a way to get rid of your weed.
Right.
So
I just feel like misdirection is gone in foreign policy. You know what I mean? Like, where is it?
Yeah. Israel would have bombed them approximately 3.5 minutes after the chemical weapons went off.
Oh,
they'd
be
like, we don't care if it was Al-Qaeda or if it was Assad. They both need to die.
Exactly.
Drop a nuke.
I know. I mean, their backs are literally against the wall.
Right.
They face death every single day. And if that's the thing, if we strike, well, that's something we haven't touched on. If we strike Syria, I guarantee you one of the Iran or another Arab country is going to strike Israel, and that is the trigger moment.
That's the danger. That's the danger is not them attacking us, but them attacking Israel. Israel will not...
Israel. We have no choice but to back Israel. Right. None.
So
we are locked in.
Why?
Why? Because if it wasn't for us...
I was just letting that one go. I knew it.
We essentially built and structured everything and placed them exactly where they are. They have the most rightful claim to that area. We support them economically. And the reason we support them is they have this understanding that we will always be their provider for military, for protection. And you can't...
So it's essentially an American colony in the Middle East.
It is.
Harry Truman created Israel.
Created it.
He felt that it was... It
so
was,
for us to say that they have the most logical like claim to the land might be a little bit of a stretch.
No, that is where... That is absolutely where all of Western history begins.
Right. And all of your religious texts will tell you that that's where all of it begins. But what makes the people claiming to be Israelis that are... in control of that portion of property.
I'm just putting my mic down.
More right human.
Might makes right. At the end of the day, they got us backing them. They have the most powerful military in the world behind them.
But why are we backing them?
Why? Because Harry Truman created it. When you, it's like Iraq.
Right.
Iraq, we toppled a tyrannical dictator that committed genocide against his people.
Right.
We had a responsibility to not just walk away and say, best of luck. Here's
good
20
luck with
bucks.
That.
You know? You are morally and at a very minimum economically obligated to help them, or at least provide guidance.
Right.
Israel is a bit different. This isn't like we're talking about we wanted to establish democracy in Israel. What we were trying to do in Israel has way deeper stories working behind the scenes. We're talking about a rightful claim to essentially where literally where Western civilization begins, the Jewish heritage. The 12 tribes of Israel. Now, granted, that's all viewed from a very ethnocentric perspective.
Exceptionally, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is no arguing whatsoever that Western civilization is the dominant force in the world right now.
I don't think you're saying that the Israelis are always right. I mean, you look.
No, God,
any
no, they're wrong all the time.
Yeah, but look at any stretch of the imagination. You go into just the. It's a very tribal. System there. They're local. They don't have local governments, you know, in many places. It's there was one documentary I was watching about a person who grew citrus trees, and they built the wall right through his farm.
Yep.
Destroyed his family. They destroyed an entire town by building the wall. And these settlements and the wall building of the wall consistently disrupt life for Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean,
and I can completely understand why they're pissed off.
They are, but at the end of the day, there is no legal pursuit any group of people has to say that we have rightful claim to this. We're living in it. We, the Midwest destiny, or the you know the
manifest
destiny
yeah.
of the Midwest. God, that's
right,
talking about ethnocentric.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
you're talking about a situation
like chubby
where
white people deserve to live here and eat orange leaf and Chipotle.
So let's say, for example, that Iran decided that the Mexican people had rightful claim to California.
Sure.
Which we could absolutely show that that land was theirs. And I mean, it's not the cradle of birth or origin of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say that Iran one day decided, okay, California is going back to Mexico and we are going to station enough tanks and nuclear bombs right here to make sure that it stays that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially the same thing that we're doing with Israel.
Except that they're not the strongest military in the world. Okay. We can talk about being civilized and we can talk
right.
about the rule of law.
Yes.
At the very end of everything is, can you back it up or can't you? Because when push comes to shove, when it was Hitler versus Hitler in Japan and Italy versus us, there was no legal repercussion for any of this. We took Normandy. We pushed them back. We killed them. And then we stopped it. There is no might makes right at the end of the day. I hate to say that because it sounds barbaric.
It sure does.
But it absolutely, when push comes to shove, that's all there is.
So that's how we make the decisions. But is that logical?
I think so. I think at the end, we try to be civilized.
So what happens when we are no longer the mightiest
then
guy?
We're the ruled.
Learn Chinese, baby.
You're
good
ruled.
God.
No. They have so much debt off the books, and they're older as a population than we are. It isn't looking good.
Well, they're on the verge of the Industrial Revolution. So should we all be smoking crocodile then? Or
I say so, yes.
With the Ruskies coming in? Hey, if you haven't Googled crocodile yet, make sure you get in right now and start. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
I mean, is that the wrong way to look at it? But in my opinion, I think that's the only pragmatic and realistic way to look at it. I hate to say it, but I really do.
I don't know. I mean, it's...
We try to obey by laws, and we will abide the law. We will abide laws that other people are bound to when we're in a mutual agreement. But that once you back out of an agreement, it makes no strategic sense to still abide by that same agreement.
We're talking about something that Harry Truman set up because of his own desire to have that lasting legacy and to fulfill prophecies. You and I had no control over that. We were born into this world. We're molded by it. We're shaped.
So it's the Lysander Spooner argument of if I didn't sign the original agreement, I am then in fact not bound by it.
Yeah, but I think in international relations, there are the less treaties, the better. It's so tough to just say because you know that as soon as the United States pulls out from any kind of backing of Israel, which is never going to happen, they're doomed. You're looking at the same thing that you're seeing in Syria. I mean, if the United States said today, we no longer support Israel, they're on their own, you'd look at massive slaughter in Israel.
And you would be primarily responsible.
And you would be responsible. So how do you deal with that delicate balance? I mean, that is the libertarian challenge in my mind. And everything, if you are elected to a city council, if you are elected to... Congress, your Rand Paul, he may not be the purest libertarian in the world, but you have to deal with certain
reality.
Things when you govern. Yeah, I mean, we can all sit here and philosophize about what life is going to be like 100 years when every single human being on the planet is a libertarian and believes in voluntary associations, but how do we deal with the reality of the situation knowing that we were all born into a world order where barbarous nature is always going to exist. Nuclear weapons exist.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
Right.
It really does. And that's why I always like the theory that one day we're all going to evolve into, you know, all these voluntary associations. The history of humanity is strong men rise and build movements and inspire.
Yep.
Whether it's supernatural, whether it's
and then
promises
it all crumbles
of eternity.
And then it all the world order crumbles into a world war, and then we all die.
But and realistically, Israel, if you have to pick between that and a Islamic caliphate, at the end of the day, the Israeli people provide much more protections and equality towards women, children, and all citizens. So I don't think it's one of those things you have
to... Towards their citizens.
Yes.
Have they
committed atrocities towards the Palestinians? Absolutely.
Right.
But at the end of the day, I believe they have a higher moral standing than anything I could understand from a Sharia law-derived legal system.
Right. So, all right. Well, this has been thoroughly depressing, as most of our shows usually
frustrating,
are.
Frustrating, yeah.
Yeah. But that is foreign policy, and hopefully you've learned something about what's taking place. It has surprised me, you know, that video of the five-minute Syrian conflict. The people who are commenting on that, of course, there's the one, you know, libertarian who's like, well, if you take a cartoon for you to understand foreign policy and what's going on in the world, then just kill yourself. It's like, you're the exact type of libertarian that really
wins
doesn't interest.
Friends
yeah.
And influences people.
Nothing influences somebody like saying kill yourself because you're an idiot.
Right.
Although it has worked for Maya. I mean, I'm just saying. But
it's not so much kill yourself, it's that I'll kill you.
Right.
No, Maya would prefer that you do it yourself.
Yeah,
she's a voluntarist.
Yeah.
There would be intervention involved.
But she would voluntarily kill you if push came to shove.
Right. But you know, so many people have said, I don't understand what's going on in Syria. What I'm not just going to say no because I don't understand it. So, you know, hopefully this has shed some light. If it has, please spread it. Please share it with your friends. Say, listen, it's a war. Take an hour and 20 minutes to figure it out. So,
worth your time.
And look at the big picture because it is a big, big deal if the rebels win.
Yeah.
It is big because I really it didn't hit me until today. And then I was thinking, oh my God, the entire continent of Africa could be an Islamic caliphate in 100 years.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, but wow, that's scary.
We're not really sure what happened to Creighton either. I'm just staring at his blank wall on his video camera. He must have had a fecal urgency of some sort.
Or Rand Paul just...
Rand Paul called the Yell House. Yeah. Ron Paul rolled up in his 1999 Buick LeSabre.
Oh, my gosh.
And said, let's go to Pizza Hut. So,
or I would drop everything for Pizza Hut with Rand.
Not Ron Paul, though.
No.
No. He had it for me.
Creighton had an emergency beard meeting. So... all right, so let's wrap up. This has been I felt like this was a good episode. So I felt I felt it was educational.
Mm-hmm.
End of show, anything that you'd like to mention? I know there certainly were other things that took place this week. Other things that you'd like to point out or anything you'd like to promote? Let's start with Gregory W. Lenz.
W.
I don't know what your middle name is, so I'm going Bush.
Yeah, it's Thomas. I'm not a Walker. I wish I was a member of the Walker family. My trust fund would be huge, according to Gina.
Right.
It's legit.
Yeah, because I'm sure there's poor Walker Bushes. Just
right.
Yeah.
As far as Syria, I wish I could give a guess. What I think we'll do is we'll do a strike. We'll do a quote-unquote punishment strike if a cruise missile can ever be considered a slap on the wrist. And all it will do will exacerbate the situation and draw us into something where we either have to tell Israel we're out and guess what, you're not pursuing this, or we're forced to the table by the Israeli lobby.
Ouch.
Gina, anything you'd like to promote? Anything you'd like to? Anything that caught your attention this week?
Yeah, some things caught my attention this week, but I can't say that I know enough about them to light that flame just yet. But
throw them out there. Hey, you've got 30 seconds.
Syria has been the number one thing on everybody's mind, I think. But there have been rumblings of, mobilization and troops being moved down south. So I'm just keeping my eyes peeled for what's coming militarily in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. I would implore you. As we sit here at this early date, almost September, as we record, brush up on the debt ceiling debate, because all you're going to be talking about in a month is
debt ceiling.
Here in the next month, by the end of the month, when these guys get back, they've got 40 days. They've got to have done by the end of the month the budgets. We're going to be talking about the debt ceiling, defunding Obamacare, shutting down the government, immigration, Syria, Egypt. There's going to be a lot of big issues, and you're going to have a lot of questions from friends and family. You're going to get into a lot of arguments on Facebook. Maybe you have done so much research that you'd like to write a guest post for WeAreLibertarians.com.
You should.
Whatever it may be, brush up on your arguments for the debt ceiling. Go to Cato, Mises, some of the great think tanks that the libertarian movement has. You can find those at theadvocates.org. We've got a list of libertarian think tanks there. Learn your facts. Get ready for it. We know it's coming. We know it's going to be huge. And listen to the show and then say, you guys forgot this fact, because you are so well educated and you are killing it on Facebook, convincing your friends. That is the thing that a study – and the reason I say this is that – we shape on Facebook our friends and family's ideas about these larger issues when we post about them. There was a study that came out that said 70% of Americans, I think it was a Harris poll, 70% of Americans were paying attention to what was going on with the NSA spying and Snowden leaks. They were watching as much about those as they could. And I thought that was really, really encouraging.
Barack Obama could save his presidency if he did one thing while he was at that summit. Meet with Edward Snowden. Just set up a meeting. Those two. If he did that, he would totally restore my confidence in him.
Yep.
Right.
Meet with him, President Obama.
Right.
Right, but how would Snowden, would Snowden be in a position to accept such an invitation
of
and
course.
Assume that he's not going to be blackbagged himself?
Yeah. He can't. I would set it up, public area. Not public, but I mean, at least with Russian security forces there, no one else. I mean, you got to have some.
Let's be honest. It'd be just like the naked chick who walked up to Vladimir Putin. I mean, Obama would smile and then they'd drag her away.
No, I mean, but I mean, schedule. I mean, if he wants to really take a chance at saving the things he does believe in, that would be a great step.
I really think he's at a point, personally, where he needs to just sack up and on these larger issues of civil liberty and war. Do the things that you said you were going to do, Mr. President.
That's all we're asking.
And this podcast will start praising you and saying nice things about you. And who doesn't want that?
And you have nothing to lose.
Right.
Nothing. You're not getting a domestic agenda thing
at the end of my presidency. I'd say the only thing that mattered is that the We Are Libertarians podcast said nice things about me.
Yes.
So 70% of people paid attention to what was going on in the NSA. If you're making stupid, or if you're making arguments that everybody else is making, or if you're making mostly negative things like, oh, you're an idiot if you pay attention to Honey Boo Boo over this, people aren't going to listen to you. People want to know what they're supposed to think about these issues. And it is your responsibility as an informed libertarian to inform your Facebook friends. That is the only thing that we have. It's not like you can go over to Syria and like sit aside down and have a nice conversation with them and say, listen, buddy, stop with the gas. Okay, you can't do that. That's not within your power. But you can inform your friends about what is going on in Syria and what is going to take place with the debt. And when we start having these big discussions about the debt, convince your friends and family that the right thing to do is to stop spending money. And here's why it matters. And here's why your life will be better now and in the future if we do it this way. If you are just going to sit there and rail against the where's Obama's birth certificate? He can't spend this money because he's not a real president.
Right.
You know, that kind
of
stuff.
8 years into his presidency.
Right. That stuff doesn't work. If you're, you know, think about what will convince you, what convinced you, and do that on your Facebook page.
Well, that's sad. Sad timing. I'm about to put mine on. I'm taking mine off life support for a month.
Oh, we'll have to discuss that in a minute.
You're going off the grid?
I am. I'm doing a digital detox.
That's actually a smart idea.
I've actually thought about that. But
yeah, I've gone without my phone for almost 3 days, which is why I'm checking it now. And I just caught myself like compulsively checking it. So I'm like,
give me that.
You got to go. Yeah. Phone's got to go.
Here. Look at the naked photos.
But the Facebook is I'm definitely going to disable it for a month.
How do you turn this thing off?
You don't. It's broken. It's a piece of dish.
So,
hey, right, we didn't have to bleep you till the very
end. No, that is not true.
Oh, that's
not
the
true.
Second one.
No, there's two other bleeps.
Believe me, there was something about the Syria situation enough to get me pissed off enough to.
There was one in the middle that I'm sorry, people. I don't know where it was, and it's not getting bleeped. Man up. So, sorry you heard a curse
word.
You can
hear my filthy, filthy female mouth. You'll be okay.
That's right. Everybody says it. Creighton is back on the camera. He's on the phone, but he's back from his fecal urgency. Unfortunately, he's now walking away from the camera, so we'll just say, hey, check out y'all. Rand Paul is awesome. That's what he'd like to promote for the end.
How much do you lift, bruh?
Yeah. Bruh. Hey,
how many PBRs does that cost, bruh?
Who wants to check out the South? It's rising again. So, all right, guys. Thanks for listening this week. Can't do better than that. Solid show.
Can't do any better
solid
than
show,
that.
But there's always room to improve. So next week, we promise.
We'll do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.